Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. On today's show, we've been speaking about mental health. Earlier, we mentioned the troubling numbers that the suicide rate in the U.S. has been increasing in the last two decades. In June, the CDC also reported that 40% of adults say they're experiencing at least one mental health effect related to the pandemic, such as depression or anxiety. September is Suicide Prevention Month, and on today's show, we wanted to offer some hope and solutions, both what we can do on an individual level and what changes need to happen at the community or governmental level. And while this is a difficult topic to talk about, our next guests will tell you that addressing the stigma around mental health is one thing we can do to help save lives. Before we go on, I want to mention that if you or someone you know needs to speak to someone, the number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. Again, that number is 800-273-8255. You can call or text that number for free 24/7. Joining us now is Dr. Kristen Kenefick. She's a bicultural, bilingual, licensed clinical psychologist and associate professor at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. Dr. Kenefick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'd also like to welcome Sebastian Klein. He's an advocate for suicide prevention and founded the Angel Forever Foundation in Champaign after losing his daughter, Angel, to suicide. Sebastian, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Steve Moore. He's co-chair of the board of directors of the Illinois chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. He's also a member of the AFSP's National Public Policy Council, which helps establish federal and state legislative priorities. Steve, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
If you have been affected by suicide in your life and you want to share your story, you can always join our conversation. Or if you have questions for our guests, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. And you can also always tweet us at 21st Show, 21st Show. Dr. Kenefick, I want to start with you. When it comes to suicide, what are some common misconceptions that you hear?
Well, there are so many. First of all, although many people do have, a mental health challenge, sometimes it's undiagnosed. So sometimes people seem to be doing just fine on the outside, but they are really covering up a lot of internal pain. So, people can be going to work, seeing their friends, seeming to be okay. And then, there's some sort of life event or crisis that leads them into this really deep and dark place where they feel like they cannot go on. So that's one of the myths.
I'm sorry, one of my producers called my attention. I think I've been mispronouncing your name, Dr. Kenefick. So my apologies for that. Can you talk about why is it important to talk about suicide? There's so much stigma around it.
Well, not only is there stigma around suicide, there's tremendous stigma around seeking help for mental health challenges. And our mental health is equally as important as our physical health, right? So most people, if they have access to healthcare, they're going for regular checkups. They're monitoring their physical health. And I hope as a country, as a society, we can get to the point where we're doing the same thing for our mental health, kids are being asked screening questions when they go to the pediatrician, for the same health checkups they need for school. So there's tremendous stigma around taking care of our mental health and tremendous stigma around things like depression and anxiety. And then sometimes people don't even know that they're suffering from something because maybe they've always felt this way. And there's this idea that, you know, if you say you can't go on anymore or you just feel like giving up, that you're a weak person, you know, that we have in this culture, you know, these sayings like pick yourself up by the bootstraps or, you know, be a man or, you know, tough it out. And these are very damaging messages for all people, especially for men, for boys, you know, that you're supposed to just, you know, get through it instead of admitting that you're in pain and that you might need help. So I'm so happy we're having this conversation today. And I hope anyone who's listening to this can go back and talk to their kids and talk to their loved ones. How are you? How are you really? And just create that space for this dialogue.
Sebastian, I want to bring you into the conversation. You became an advocate for suicide prevention after losing your daughter when she was a young teenager. But before we talk about some of the work you're doing, would you mind sharing with us what your daughter was like?
Yeah. In my opinion, as a parent, Angel was the perfect kid. You know, all the way up until she was 12, just turning 13, I thought, like, wow, I'm so blessed to have such a perfect child, you know? And I think I always emphasize, I can only think of what was going through her mind or what she was thinking, you know, at various times of her life. But I think at this point, I realized that she suffered in silence a lot of her life. And just by putting certain pieces together, I think a lot of her behaviors were exactly what Kristen, right?
Yeah.
What you were talking about, how she either didn't want to express her pain or didn't know how to express her pain or whatever it was that she was feeling. So she just covered it up by always acting like everything was fine and everything's okay and everything's great. She was a straight A student, honor roll every year, won awards. She was a writer, an artist. She loved to sing, and something just really started changing when she hit 13 and she began to self-harm, but still throughout these signs that I started to see, she still continued to live her life as though everything was great, smiling all the time, laughing, hanging out with her friends, making straight A's in school. And it just, you know, at this point, it sounds almost cliche to say it, but it just came as such a shock. Like, I never went to bed at night worrying that she was, you know, thinking of suicide. I went to bed worrying about her, but it was never that strong of a worry. And so for her to end up dying by suicide, I suffered my entire life from depression and anxiety, severe depression. I'm a suicide attempt survivor myself. So to lose my child to something that I suffered with was just beyond profound. And I thought, I just immediately thought, you know, I was under the impression that how could I not see the signs? How could I not notice certain things when this is something that I've dealt with my whole life? And that was really the the reason why I just wanted to do something. I didn't want to just allow Angel to become a statistic.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that, Sebastian. Steve Moore, I want to bring you into the conversation as well. You're the, as I said earlier, co-chair of the board of directors of the Illinois chapter for the American Federation for Suicide Prevention. As I understand, you became involved in mental health advocacy work after losing your son to suicide when he was 19. Can you tell us about him?
Yes. Paul sounded like he was the male version of Angel. He was a bright, energetic, artistic child. He went to one of the Northside College Prep in one of the top magnet schools in the city of Chicago, went on to college at Grinnell University. He never really showed signs of depression or any kind of a mental illness that we saw. So his suicide really, came out of the blue. Now, in retrospect, talking to teachers, friends, there's a police investigation, all of that, it looks like he probably was, had developed anxiety and depression. But he was, smart enough to hide it. And, somewhere in there, he was struggling and decided to take his life. And, I'll never know the exact details of why, but, what I always like to think of is, how good he was during his life. I much rather think of Paul as he lived rather than how or why he died. I also like to think that the world is a lesser place because he's not here anymore. One of the things that I do in my volunteer work, in addition to AFSP, is I am a facilitator for survivor support group at Catholic Charities here in Chicago. So I've heard probably hundreds of parents, siblings, children talking about the loss of their relatives, their children, their parents, their siblings, their lovers, their friends. Just without fail, none of us can ever understand why that person did it. And almost without fail, we also think that the world is a lesser place because of the people we lost. It's this world, misses those people. They all had aspects to them that were good, that were helping others, that would have made this a better place. And, that's one reason that I've gotten involved in this. I just see suicide as something that devastates the survivors and that really affects all of us. I mean, there's so many people that Paul could have helped and could have inspired if he had grown up and lived a full life. And it's a tragedy that he's not here anymore. So that's how I got involved.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're having a difficult but important conversation on the show today. September is Suicide Awareness Month. We're talking with experts and advocates about ways we can help save lives, both what we can do as individuals and what work needs to be done at the broader community or state level. We are speaking with Steve Moore with the Illinois chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Sebastian Klein, founder of the Angel Forever Foundation, which works to prevent suicide, and Dr. Kristen Velasquez-Kenefic, who's a clinical psychologist and professor at the Chicago School of Clinical Psychology. We need to take a break in about 3 minutes, but before that, Kristen, I want to ask if, the stories that Sebastian and Steve shared, and again, thank you for sharing those stories. Does that sound familiar to you?
Absolutely. And I just want to applaud. I'm just, first of all, just so devastated by your losses, but so happy you're speaking out and, educating parents and others, that we, mental health is part of overall health is critical. That's one way, maybe we can, start, prevention, more prevention.
And we may never know, as Steve said, we may never know why someone chooses to take their life. But Kristen, as we've talked about how suicide rates are going up among several groups, especially young people, what are some of the warning signs we can look for?
Yeah, well, there are some warning signs, but again, I just want to validate Steve and Sebastian that sometimes there are no warning signs.
Absolutely.
But sometimes people talk about they just can't take it anymore. There's no reason to live. You know, they are feeling trapped. So those are some of the things you might hear from people. Sometimes there is a change in people's behavior. So they stop doing things that they used to like to do, or they might start, you know, sleeping more than usual. Sometimes they might start giving things away important to them. And really these warning signs that we should all be aware of in terms of mood issues. So just when you know someone well and you know how they usually are in the course of life, when you see some sort of change, it's great to check in and say, you know, I notice you seem a little different. You know, is something bothering you? So, you know, sometimes people really try to hide it, but there's just little subtle signs, like they're not as joyful, they're not as connected. Maybe if they're kids, they're not connecting with their friends, they're not texting their friends back, they're not, well, we're under quarantine in a lot of areas, but, you know, if kids stop going to meet their friends or stop participating in activities, sometimes those can be signs. But again, as Sebastian and Steve mentioned, sometimes people are faking it and they're not, you know, showing signs. And that's why we need, you know, broader education around these topics and really more screening, you know.
But let's pause here. We need to take a break and we will talk about some of the things that you think we should be doing about this as individuals and as a society. We're going to continue this conversation after our break. This is The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're having a difficult but important conversation on the show today. This is Suicide Awareness Month. This is Suicide Prevention Week. And we're talking with experts and advocates about ways we can help save lives, both individually and what we need to be doing as a society through our governments to help save lives. We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Kristen Velasquez-Kenefick. She's a clinical psychologist and professor at the Chicago School of Clinical Psychology. We're also speaking with Steve Moore with the Illinois chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and Sebastian Klein, founder of the Angel Forever Foundation, which works to prevent suicide. Oh, just one more time, want to mention before we go on that if you or someone you know needs to speak to someone, the number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. You can call that number, text it for free, 24/7. We'll also post that on our website at 21stshow.org. And listeners, I also want to invite you to join our conversation. If you have a story you want to share about how suicide has affected you or a loved one in your life, our number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Jerry in Urbana, you've been waiting patiently. Thank you for doing that, and thank you for calling in. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. I attempted suicide at the age of 17, and it was the middle 70s. I grew up on a farm and small, you know, farming community. And I was having difficulty with accepting the fact that I was attracted to guys. And that was something you just didn't talk about back then. And I never imagined that I could talk to my parents about it and or anyone else. So I was suicidal inside, but I was one of those people that hid it very well. I got involved in all kinds of activities. I dated women to hide. I didn't want anybody to suspect what my issues were. And I'll spare you the whole story, but then I kind of delved into drinking and then got sober at the age of 25. I've been sober now for 39 years. That's been wonderful because the alcoholism was kind of a slow form of suicide. And then I lost my brother, 4 years older than me, to suicide in 1991. And it was actually September 12th. So this is an apt week to be talking about it because it's the 29th anniversary of his suicide. But I've been very active with AFSP, both in the walks and several years they've had programs out at Parkland College for survivors of suicide. And I've gone in and talked about that in terms of long-term survivorship because it's been a while. But one of the things I remember reading, and I'll ask your experts on this, is that it's important for those of us that have attempted to talk about it and be open. You don't need to tell details, but just that you were that low at one point in time and that you're so, so very glad that you didn't do it, which is just absolutely the case for me. I think about everything I would have missed out on. And oftentimes families just want to shut up about what happened. And that was the case for my parents, even though they found my brother and it was just devastating at the time. And they had some long-term effects for several years. But then I got to the point where my mother just didn't want to talk about it. I'd try to bring up Steve and she would just be quiet. And it was obvious she didn't want to talk about it. And I want to make sure that my nieces and nephews understand the threat of depression that runs through the family and the dangers of, you know, alcoholism, because there's a history of it in our family. And I think it's rampant in probably a lot of people's families. So is it good to tell your story along those lines? I certainly don't want to hurt anyone in terms of telling it that way. So no, Jerry, that's kind of a comment and a question.
No, I appreciate that, Jerry. And I want to ask you, I mean, thank you so much for sharing your story of both yourself and your brother. Is this something that took you a while to come around to being able to speak openly about it? Was that a struggle for you?
Well, I guess over the years, I became more open about it. And I think the more that I learned about it when I did a lot of reading early on, my parents were actually open for a while. We went to a suicide survivors group. There wasn't any in Champaign-Urbana at the time. And they would actually come visit me from Iowa, and we would drive over to Decatur. So they were open to reading. And but then they got to the point where it was like it was past. It was behind them. And I call her my stoic Swedish mother. She's gone now, but she just got to the point where she didn't want me to talk about, oh, it was Steve's birthday, or I'm thinking about you today because it was the anniversary of Steve's suicide. And I guess I've read a lot about it, and I want to know whether that's still kind of the case.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you, Jerry, so much for calling in. Please call us again. And thank you for sharing your story. Steve, I want to ask you about both what Jerry said, and, you know, as we've heard from you and Sebastian and from him, often there are not signs, you know, that we should reach out to someone. So, I mean, it really goes beyond reaching out to someone on an individual level, how we can offer support. I understand your organization is rewriting the Illinois Suicide Prevention Strategy. Can you talk about that, or if you want to respond to Jerry specifically?
Yeah, first, I would like to respond to Jerry specifically. Yes, you know, it's very valuable, actually, to tell your story. When I first got involved with AFSP, it was primarily an organization of people like me that had lost someone to suicide. And we realized that people like Jerry that have had survived attempts are really the ones that are important out there to tell their story, because they have a story of hope. That, you know, there is recovery from suicide attempt, you know, not only physically recovering, but then going on to live a purposeful, meaningful life. Absolutely be willing to tell your story. Don't tell details. I mean, we do not advocate, giving people the exact details of how one made their attempt. But just the fact that, you know, you got to that point and made an attempt, but you've recovered. And, really the whole concept of hope is just so important. And people that have survived an attempt are, you know, the prime examples of people that have can show hope. So definitely, Jerry, do tell your story, you know, be willing to share that with people, you know, with your nieces and nephews and anyone else. You know, do it in a way that doesn't give detail, but just that whole concept of I got helped, I got changed, and I'm now a better person is really important. Now, as for the plan, actually, the Illinois Suicide Prevention Alliance, which is a state organized body, in fact, there's a statute that created it, and it consists of various state agencies that have some aspect of, you know, interest in suicide prevention. For example, the Illinois State Board of Education is a member, Department of Aging. I mean, they've got, obviously, their clients are at risk for suicide, so they want to be involved. Also, organizations like AFSP. I happen to be the co-chair of the Alliance right now. And last summer or spring, the General Assembly passed a law that somewhat reorganized the Alliance, and it created an obligation that we create a new state strategy. So I've been involved in helping write a new state strategy for the state. The other important thing for that bill was that it required the Department of Public Health to start, you know, actually get involved in suicide prevention, you know, hire someone to, you know, manage the state's plan. Because right now there is no officer within the state that's responsible for suicide prevention. It was just really volunteers like me and, you know, people, part-timers from various state agencies that, you know, appeared at our meetings every quarter, but, you know, went back to their office and really weren't working on suicide prevention. So, you know, we are working on a new plan. It's pretty close to done. I mean, I've, you know, we've got drafts that have been completed, and it's got a lot of detail of how communities, employers, public interest organizations, individuals, government can all get involved in suicide prevention, because suicide prevention is a public health issue. And, you know, I think now all of us with COVID are seeing what public health means. It means everybody gets involved. It's something that, you know, you take seriously and, you know, figure out how I can have a part in that, because we all are with COVID, you know, all of us has a role to play. You know, suicide prevention, we all have a role to play. Could be mental health, you know, trying to promote mental health. You know, on suicide prevention, there's really sort of two sides of the coin. One is the risk factors. You know, people, certain occupations, certain cultures have risk factors, but we also all have protective factors. The protective factors may be, you know, your family, your church, the people, your friends, the job you have, you know, things that make you happy, that keep you busy, that keep your mind occupied, that give your life some sort of a purpose. And so each of these, you know, communities, and when I say community, I mean it very broadly. It could be where you live, where you play, where you worship. It could be your ethnic background. It could be your race. All these are different communities that have risk factors and that have protective factors. And so it's important that we promote the protective factors and do our best to reduce those risk factors. And so, again, that's a public health issue that we can all take an active role in.
Yeah. And Sebastian, I want to ask you, one of the things Steve just said is we all have a role to play. And one of those roles is supporting people who have lost loved ones to suicide. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what the best way we can do that is.
The best way to support people who have lost others to suicide?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, one of the things that I advocate is empathy. Unfortunately, I think, you know, not necessarily due to any particular fault, but it's just very common within all society that we lack empathy. Example is whenever we're, I think it's just kind of a natural human response when we hear somebody who wants to talk about something that is bothering them or something that they're suffering from, we immediately want to counteract it by bringing, you know, saying something how we relate to it by a personal experience we have. And that takes away from what they're wanting to talk about immediately, because we make it all about us. So I think just really being proactive in advocating empathy and for people to realize that it takes a lot for someone to just get to the point where they want to talk about whatever it is that they're challenged with or suffering from. And so it's extremely important that we keep the focus on them and let them talk and listen to what they have to say and then have empathy for them and not make it about us.
And we've only got a couple of minutes left in our conversation, but Kristen, I want to close with you. In addition to teaching, you're also a psychotherapist with a private practice. I wonder, do you see flaws in our mental health care system that you think need to be addressed in order to prevent suicide?
Absolutely. Health care and mental health care specifically have to be accessible to everyone, you know, to every person. And there, we cannot meet the demand right now. Our country is in the midst of a mental health crisis. And I'm in private practice. I can't even imagine, you know, the public clinics, I'm sure, are so overwhelmed. So we need to pass healthcare legislation. We need to reopen clinics that have been closed. And also, I just want to say one thing that we can all do is speak openly about our struggles, even if we haven't attempted suicide. But if we are struggling with a mental health challenge, having a bad day, if we can speak openly about it to others, it gives permission, you know, both to our kids, our neighbors, our family members, to say, it's okay to talk to someone when I don't feel good. Mm-hmm. Because right now, we do not have enough providers to meet the need. So really building up our communities. And I'm so impressed with the people that are joining this conversation and all the work that they're doing to create these prevention programs.
And I'm afraid we have to leave it there. Dr. Kristen Velasquez-Kenefic is professor at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. We've also been speaking with Sebastian Klein, who's an advocate and founder of the Angel Forever Foundation in Champaign, and Steve Moore, co-chair of the board of directors of the Illinois chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Thank you all so much for being here with us today and sharing your stories. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.